Good morning and welcome into the 9 to 10 hour for this Friday, the 6th of June. This is American DA Live, brought to you by Landscapers Corner, 1305 Old Frankfort Pike, Landscapers Corner, with the Triple Crown Elite grass seed that everybody's talking about, available in 5, 25, and 50-pound bags. Call 225-9433. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Jack.
Congratulations, 45 years married to the beautiful wife that you have, and you took her out someplace nice last night.
I did.
Spent some money on her.
Yes.
That's nice.
Well, she allowed me to spend money.
Ah, you know, okay.
The secret, listen, she didn't give me any money.
She doesn't?
No, because she knows over the years that if I've got money, we all got money.
And
it's gone by the end of the day.
Well, I congratulate you both.
Thank you. Betty's a good catch for me.
She was a very good catch. It is a very good catch.
Outkicked my coverage.
We've got a couple of friends of ours with us this morning.
Well, Dan Laren is with us. He was a prosecutor in a case involving a murder case involving a defendant named Terrence Sims, who was convicted of killing Stephen Cavanaugh. It was determined to be a cold case because they didn't solve it right away. It was a cool case.
Yeah, is there a particular length of time before they're officially a cold case?
I don't know that. Do you know, Dan?
I don't think so. I don't think there's an official number. This case was described by the detectives as a cold case because it happened in June of 2010, and I'll talk in some more detail about the evidence that was recovered, but it included a shirt that had some DNA on it, and we had to wait basically until...
Don't give the case away,
okay,
Dan.
But, you know, we know by TV, and that's where, you know, I got my degree,
that
the first 48, you know, kind of taught us all that after 48 hours, the trail starts to get cold, and 48 mm-hmm. hours is not much time.
I think there is some truth to that.
Yeah.
In this case, it was about 3 years.
Here's what I think. They classified it as a cold case by the homicide unit because Chris Schoonover is a detective, and he's the cold case detective, and I think probably is listening, and I just wanted to say that they classified it as a cold case so that he could have some success statistics on solving a cold case.
That's what I think.
It's all about Chris Schoonover.
Oh, okay, good.
Right.
Good.
And with us also is Mary Houlihan, who is our Director of Victim Services and is what I consider to be a bright light in the victim services business. There's mm-hmm. no more money in her check as a result, but she's done a great deal for us in that department. And Mary, you had to work with this family as a cold case developed. And how does the fact that a case isn't solved affect the family of the victim?
Well, the difficult thing for us is that we're not involved until a case is charged. And so there's not really, especially at the time, a victim advocate. The police have now gotten some victim advocates for cases other than domestic violence. But previous to that, there wouldn't be an advocate working with the family to explain what's going on and give information about the status of the investigation. And so I didn't work with the family back when the murder occurred. But from working with them, you really realize they've gone through a grief process that you're kind of pulling them back into when you do solve it. But this was the victim in this case had a large and really wonderful family to work with that really taught me a lot about how much it mattered to them that it was finally solved and how much that did for them.
Let me jump in here just for a second. We tried to get Dan Kett on with us earlier this morning and couldn't connect with him. Completely going to change gears just for a couple minutes. Dan, with the Bluegrass Boy Scout Council, and today, of course, is D-Day, the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Dan, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Jack. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Tell us about this honor flight that's taken off at 10 o'clock this morning from Bluegrass Airport. Who's going to be on it, what they're going to do, and all that?
Well, I'll tell you, Jack, it's going to be a really exciting day It's the Honor Flight Bluegrass, and it's going to be taking a group of veterans, 30 veterans and their guardians here from Lexington, and then another 50 veterans and their guardians from Louisville will be heading to Washington, D.C. today. This has all been made possible by the folks at Hallway Feeds, and they will be touring the war memorials, monuments, making a full day of it in D.C. And then tonight, the Lexington contingent will arrive home first. They'll be landing at the Lexington Bluegrass Airport at 7:45. And what we're trying to do is get all of the community to come out and welcome home these heroes.
How many scouts and scouters are going to be there, Dan?
We're up to close to 200 scouts and scouters that'll be on hand this evening.
That's great. My friend that plays in the Bluegrass, I guess it's called the Bluegrass Pipe Band, Ross Martin, said that the pipe band's going to be out there. It's going to be a nice welcome home.
It really is. It's going to be the sort of welcome home that these heroes truly deserve. You're going to have veterans from World War II. Specifically, there's going to be a gentleman who was there at Omaha Beach, and we'll have some veterans from Korea and Vietnam as well. But I'll tell you, talk about a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, Jack. These heroes are, we're losing them at a clip of almost 1,500 a day.
I've heard that, yeah.
So for our, for our community, especially our young people, to come out and really celebrate what this greatest generation did for our country, it's just, it's very humbling.
Well, so the whole message this morning is come on out of the airport. I've had a couple of calls, people saying, where do you go when you get there? Will they be directing folks?
They will. My understanding is there will be a line similar to when the UK players arrive home from a game to welcome them home. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some opportunities inside in the baggage area, and then also outside. They're going to line us up, and certainly encourage folks to bring an American.
Whoops, we lost you, Dan. Okay, I'm sure he was saying bring an American flag, and we appreciate Dan Kett, all the great work he does with the Boy Scouts of the Bluegrass. We're going to take Bluegrass Council of the Boy Scouts. We're going to take a break. We come back, we'll get back to our topic today, a cold case, here on this Forensic Friday on News Talk 590 WVLK. And we are back. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson, Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Dan Lahren is with us in the studio, along with Mary Houlihan, victim services person in the office down at the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. And Mary, you said something interesting in the break when I was talking about Hospice of the Bluegrass. You guys do referrals to hospice for victims that have lost loved ones to crime?
Yeah, it's a really important aspect to me of what hospice does, and I love to give them a shout out because it's the single most common referral we make for murder cases is that the victims' families get grief counseling, and hospice provides that service at no cost to those victims. And sometimes it's just so hard to find the right referral to make in the aftermath of such a trauma. But this case would be an example of that would be a service that I didn't even get to connect them to at the time that they suffered their loss.
I appreciate that. I never knew that, right?
Okay, Dan, tell us a little bit about the murder of Stephen Cavanaugh.
Well, this case took place on a Friday night, June the 4th of 2010. We had some 911 calls and some dispatches. In this particular case, there was a patrol officer that was on foot in the area. This is Ellesmere Alley, which runs between 6th and 7th Street here in the downtown central sector area. That officer heard two gunshots, and he ran a short distance, less than a couple of blocks, and he got to the scene, and he saw the victim lying down and somebody leaning over the victim. And this suspect, I guess he was at that point, stood up, saw the officer, ran away, jumped a fence, and bolted. The officer started to chase him, but then stopped and went to the victim and tried to save the victim. So it went pretty quickly from there. The other patrol units and
what
the other people came back.
What kind of injury did the victim suffer?
He had two gunshot wounds, both of which were pretty much on the upper left side of his body. The one that turned out to be lethal went through sort of near his neckline, clavicle, and he had a second shot on his chest.
Did he ultimately end up bleeding to death?
Right. That was pretty much how it came out. He was deceased at the scene.
Right.
And when the medical examiner did the autopsy and ultimately testified, the cause of death was hypovolemic shock, which meant that he bled out from the injuries caused by these bullet wounds.
And when that happens, when the victim is dead at the scene, that changes the whole complexion of that investigation, doesn't it, as far as you don't move the body and you all that kind of stuff, right?
Well, I went to that scene.
Did you?
Yeah. And, yeah, if that's the case, and if it's in a, you know, for example, if it's in a public place, kind of where a lot of people can see, they set up screens and that sort of thing around the body because it's important that they leave the body there.
Yeah.
Now, if there's any indication of life, pulse or any kind of heartbeat or anything, the emergency medical people do what they call scoop and run, because they just scoop them up on a backboard, mm-hmm, and put them in the ambulance and head on. They do a great job. Okay, so Dan, tell us.
Well, the first thing that happened in this case is that the patrol officers tried to recover what property they could, physical evidence from the scene. And then the forensic services people came out, the detectives, and gathered a number of things. Basically,
the difference between a forensic services person and a homicide detective?
Well, forensic services are our CSI people. You know, like you said, Jack, you got your degree from TV, and so do our jurors. You know, so when jurors watch CSI, they want to see the crime van come out and the detectives come out and swab things and dust things for prints. That's what forensic services does, and in this case, it was critical to our success.
See, we call it the CSI effect.
Yeah,
and jurors have to be educated that that what they see on CSI doesn't necessarily reflect reality.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that CSI doesn't work. For example, you get a fingerprint, put it in the machine, the picture of a defendant comes up. Doesn't work like that,
right,
in 10 seconds. And the cases are seldom solved in 42 minutes. So...
Were there any shell casings or anything like
there
that?
There was. There was one shell casing located near the body, and then I believe that the medical examiner recovered the bullet from the victim's body.
Now, do you remember what
the
caliber weapon it was?
I believe it was a 9mm.
And we've learned through the show, Ray, that tells us it was a semi-automatic weapon, because if it had been a revolver, there would be no shell casing.
That's
See
right.
what I've learned?
There you
That's
go.
True, and I'll tell you. It's very interesting, Jack, when you are involved in a jury trial, talking about things like that,
mm-hmm,
are very, seen from talking to jurors after cases, they say that sort of thing is very interesting.
I think
that
it is, too.
They really didn't know that sort of fact.
The other, some other information that was located, I mean, of course, originally the patrol officers did not know who the victim was. There was a cooler, a red and white kind of standard, you know, a picnic cooler in the alley. And in the cooler, there were a number of things. There were some court papers that identified this victim as Stephen Cavanaugh. His family knew him as Buddy. So it was Buddy's cooler. And there were court papers that indicated he had paid child support that very same day. He'd gone down to the courthouse and paid some money. There was a paycheck stub. I can't remember where he worked, but it indicated he was a working man.
Mm-hmm.
He was wearing his clothes, indicated that he had been working. They found a number of other things. There was a box cutter in the cooler. There was some beer. There were some beer cans around. It suggested that Buddy had been drinking after he worked, paid his fines, and then he was having a couple of beers on a Friday night, which is not an unknown activity here in Lexington.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other things that were kind of scattered around. His wallet was there. His wallet was empty, but there was $50 on the ground near his hand, and that became pretty important later on. So that was most of the physical evidence that was recovered. The detectives also did what they call a neighborhood canvas. They went up and down the alley. Basically, this alley is the back doors to the houses on 6th and 7th Street. So they talked to the witnesses, talked to a couple of people who ended up testifying at the trial.
So they did have witnesses.
Right.
To the crime.
They couldn't identify the suspect,
yeah,
but they were all absolutely agreed that this guy was wearing a white T-shirt. He stood up, he ran. Our officer saw him. He jumped the fence, went through a couple of yards, and then ran past another house where he took the white shirt off and kept running, and then
escaped. Did he throw the shirt down?
He did.
And that, recover that?
That was the key to the case, was
really?
That white shirt.
No kidding.
And the reason, of course, he did that is because he knew that the police would be looking for a tall African-American male wearing a white T-shirt.
So when they found that out, they immediately went in search of that shirt, I guess.
Right. Yeah. The forensic services unit collected that shirt. The woman who was sitting on the porch saw him run by, drop the shirt. They talked to her. She directed forensic services, and it was Detective Bill Reeker that collected that white T-shirt.
That's interesting. We'll take a break. 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere. 1-877-777-0. And we're back with Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson, Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Dan Lahren, and Mary Houlihan from the victims section. You know, we talk about victims more often than we talk about criminals on this show, because the victims are really the ones that are the most important to you, aren't they, Ray?
Yeah, and they're the ones that are forgotten.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody talks about these stinking criminals. Excuse me. These charged people.
Right.
And they forget. I don't care what kind of sentence this Terrence Sims got. Stephen Kavanaugh's family has been sentenced to a life of grief.
Right.
They've been sentenced to life. And those people, victims, are the forgotten people, and it sends me straight up and scatters. Okay. Dan, so let's get with it. We got the white shirt that the forensic services unit collected as evidence. So what happens?
Well, they sent the shirt to the lab, and it was analyzed. They found small spots of Buddy's blood on the front of the T-shirt, and then they took a swab around the neck area, which is where DNA would be recovered. And we had a DNA profile.
Let's do some teaching here. That would be what they call contact DNA. What does that mean?
Basically, if you handle something, or if you brush up against something, you know, you pick up a book or a gun, or you lean up against a wall, there's a chance that you will leave touch DNA or contact DNA.
Cells.
Surface,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, at the CSI effect, our problem is everybody thinks that, you know, you just leave a trail of DNA when you walk through your day, and that's not how it happens. But in this case, because it was the suspect's shirt, he'd worn it a while, that we had a DNA profile, but we didn't have anybody to match it to
right
at this point, and that's when the case went cold.
So what happens is they send it to the crime lab. They swab the neck of his T-shirt, white T-shirt, and they first of all determine whether or not that contains any DNA. It did. And then they analyze the DNA, and they have a DNA profile.
But no name.
Then no name.
Right.
And so
right.
What do they do with that DNA profile?
It goes into what we call the CODIS system, which is a national system of DNA profiles. For example, if you're convicted of a violent offense or sexual offense, as part of your processing into the correction system, they take a DNA sample from you, put it into the system. So in this particular case, the profile sat in the system for about 3 years. What had happened is the suspect traveled back to Michigan, which is where he's from. And
is he from Detroit,
I believe he is.
We get a lot of characters from Detroit that are processed through our criminal justice system.
And let me say, Jack, I feel like I'm a part of a quota system, because as you might be aware, I grew up in Michigan.
Right.
I never lived in Detroit, but I feel like I came down as you know, with a couple of police officers from Michigan to deal with my friends from the Motor City who are coming into our community and shooting people and dealing drugs. And
so we blame Dan for all
it's,
of
that. Sure. I-75.
Let me ask, the fact that he went back to Michigan
right.
Delayed the hit on the DNA?
It did. The way we found out about him is he committed some sort of a narcotics offense up in Michigan. We never did get the records from their corrections department, but I believe it was a misdemeanor attempt of some sort. But he was put on probation. His DNA went into the system in Michigan, at which point we got notification from our lab that this profile had been matched up. So now we had a suspect. And the two detectives who put this case together.
Let me ask another question.
Mm-hmm.
So how often are these DNA profiles run against recently arrested people around the country? Do you have any idea?
I'm not sure if I know that. I think maybe when they put somebody in, the system just looks for a match. I don't. The way we got the notice is that the lab contacted us, contacted the police department,
and
CC'd us, and said your profile has a match.
That's interesting. Three years later,
he was arrested. He goes in.
Right. Yeah.
And there's a DNA match, and
don't they give you odds of the
right?
Do you remember what they were by chance?
I want to say it was 96 quintillion.
Pretty good odds,
right?
You got it's the right guy.
Well,
right.
Now how many people are there in the world?
I think it's about 8 billion, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. So, this is the guy.
This is the guy, but you got to prove that he did the murder, obviously.
Exactly. You can't just convict a guy based on
DNA.
Yeah, okay.
Right. So in this case, the two detectives that put this case together, Sergeant Matt Brotherton and Detective Rob Wilson, I believe they've both been here a couple of times.
Yeah. Rob's a troublemaker.
Right. Well, he's in district court this morning dealing with another case, and Sergeant Brotherton is doing some sort of recruit training. I know they wanted to be here, but unfortunately, this is what we have. But based on that DNA hit, they traveled up to Michigan in June of 2013, and they met with this Sims character who was either in custody or at the sheriff's office, I think, with his probation officer. Read him his rights, interviewed him, and he told four different stories, but he eventually admitted that he was in the area, that he had shot Buddy, and that he had done so either in self-defense or because Buddy was attempting to rob him. So now we have an identification and an admission that he did the shooting. So they arrested Mr. Sims. He was transported back here, and the case went through our system.
Okay, now, Mary, let's talk a little bit about we now have a case in our system, and what sort of contact and work with the family of the victim in this case, Stephen Cavanaugh, occurs from our office?
Well, the 3-year different time difference and not having a case that was solved right when the crime occurred actually really hampers our ability to get in touch with victims, because that's certainly, understandably, not the police goal, is to develop who the family is and everything else when they're not involved with the crime. And so initially, I believe the first person that I made contact with was the victim's stepmother, who then put me in touch with different family members as we went through the case. But really, as sometimes happens, there was a lot of family that was from out of town. Buddy has three sisters, two of whom don't live in state. And so really, I met the family at the trial in person. And they were, like I said, lovely to work with. They were huge supporters of what we did, and were with us through the trial and shared a lot with me about their grief experience. His mother, the victim's mother, didn't live in state either, and so she traveled up here, as did his sisters that were out of state, to be here for the trial. And watching a family go through a trial is a really tough thing, because they're having to sit there. The trials aren't about the victims. They're about the bad guy. And the bad guy is going to use anything he can to try and put the blame elsewhere. And what they basically do is always blame the victim.
You know, Jack, I always tell survivors of homicide victims that they think that the trial is going to take care of all of this pain that they have. And I said, that won't happen. In fact, it will make it work. It's like ripping the scab off, because it brings it all back to the surface, and you have to live through it. And in a trial, it typically, anything trashy that can be said about the victim typically is said, mm-hmm. and it's just very, very hurtful and offensive to most survivors of homicide victims. And so they have to go through that.
And they have to go through it without tears, without having emotional reactions to what they're seeing. You all already talked about this case being different, where the victim was photographed on scene after being shot. That's evidence.
Yeah.
And that's going to be shown at trial. And this family, my job as victim advocate is to keep them from reacting because everything in the courtroom is being filmed. And we
prepare them for all that, right?
I try and prepare them in whatever way they feel most comfortable. So I'm either telling them when we're about to show pictures, which is the only side I can have any input on, and give them warning about and let them get out of the courtroom, or if they choose to stay in. Sometimes they choose to see those pictures in advance to prepare themselves for what they're going to see. But it's very important that they don't have an emotional reaction that's then part of the court process, that then the defense, after they get found guilty, can look back and say, we were trying to bias the jury by having an emotional reaction to seeing your dead child. I just don't get it, but I try and help victims to behave.
They do that? Really?
They do that.
Well, there have been many times that judges will say, if you can't control yourself, then you need to leave the courtroom. And so Mary tells them that. And,
so we try and work out in advance what our plans are for dealing with this horrible information. And this family was the epitome of grace under pressure.
And you also, I'm sure they're going to say everything nasty that they can think of to say.
You know, that's another interesting thing. Yeah, you tell them that, you get them prepared, but you never know exactly what's going to be said until it's said at trial. And so it's you know, you have to get a family to trust you and to know that you're doing your best, but you can't possibly prepare them for everything that's going to be said.
Let's take a break. 253, 10 minutes before 10 o'clock, News Talk 590, WVLK. And Ray, we're down to about 5 minutes here, and we haven't gotten to the trial yet.
Well, we got this guy arrested through the DNA hit while he was in Michigan for committing a murder in Lexington. Mm-hmm. So, Dan, how long after the homicide did the trial occur?
It was just under 4 years.
All right.
From homicide to trial. We tried this case in March of 2014. Aspen Carlisle and I were the prosecutors, and the case went to trial. Like Mary said, you know, the defense was self-defense, and they did their best to trash Buddy. And as the family told us, and as we know, Buddy was not an angel. I mean, he had some issues. He was his autopsy showed he was positive for some controlled substances and alcohol. There was some the items that were recovered indicated that, you know, he was hanging out in an alley drinking.
Right. And you said something earlier. I'm sure you're going to tell us about a $50.
Well, that's kind of where this thing all started. You know, the defendant said that, first he said he wasn't there, then he said he was there, and it was another big guy that attacked Buddy. Then he said Buddy tried to rob him, Buddy had a gun, and then he said, Buddy, I had the gun, Buddy tried to take it from me, and I was defending myself. And for me, that's kind of where the whole case started. Why is that $50 out and on the ground? And the argument that I made that I think was, in my humble opinion, a pretty good one, was that the defendant was back there either trying to rob Buddy or set him up with a drug deal. Because, you know, the defendant made some argument about how he was telling Buddy, he was helping Buddy buy some drugs. And Buddy was from Lexington and didn't need any help to find things. You know, Sims is from Detroit, and he's the only guy with a gun. He's back there in the alley. And so there was some argument. The defense tried to argue that Buddy was trying to commit the robbery, and that's, you know, that Sims panicked and ran away and left the money. And I just don't think that was consistent with what Mr. Sims did in leaving the area, then leaving the state, and then lying about it when he was confronted by the detectives. So it was a pretty energetic trial, I guess. The defense attorneys kind of put on a show to try to convince the jury that that this was all Buddy's fault and that Sims was acting in self-defense. We called a number of witnesses. The patrol officers were important witnesses because they froze the scene pretty quickly. The detectives did the canvas. We had the neighbors that saw the suspect run away that identified the white shirt. We had our lab people who did the analysis on the bullets, the medical examiner. We talked about the DNA, which
did you ever get the weapon?
Important.
By the way, did you ever recover the weapon?
Okay. The police recovered a couple of weapons that they thought may have been involved, but we never did get a ballistics match. And so, the eyewitnesses were important to us. ID, everybody else. Finally, it was Detective Brotherton that testified. Detective Wilson could have as well. But he talked about how they went up and confronted this defendant. And the defense made a big deal about the fact that they had misled Mr. Sims, or they weren't honest with him, and they made a big deal about the fact that Sims didn't really confess, that it was the police's fault for that interview. And Detective Brotherton did an excellent job of explaining how, you know, we have a little bit of information and we go confront this guy. We're trying to find the truth. Mm-hmm. And we gave him the opportunity to tell us the truth, and he gave us four different stories. Defendant, as I recall, did testify at trial and tried to convince the jury that he was justified in ending Buddy's life. The jury thought it over for a few hours and returned a verdict of murder as charged.
Brag on him a little bit. You did off the air. We got a minute and a half.
Off the air. That this was going into this case, we were all in the office. We all know about these cases, and we were all in the office concerned that this was going to be turn out to be a manslaughter second degree conviction. At a point, lawyers graduate into being persuaders. And Dan was able to kick his game up to the point that this was a case where he was able to present this case in such a way that the jury believed his position on it, and as a result, they convicted a murder, and we were very proud of him. And like I said before, there'd be no more money.
Right, exactly. Sentence. So what was he sentenced to?
35 years. His original sentencing was pushed back, and he was sentenced last week to serve 35 years. I checked on him. He's still at the Fayette County Detention Center. They haven't computed his parole eligibility, but it'll be a while.
10 seconds. How did the family do?
They did wonderfully. They're following the case. They're present at sentencing and will send all their letters to the parole board.
Thank you, guys. Have a great weekend. I'll be back Monday morning at 6, 5 Central.